Hello there, loyal listeners. Well, at long last, we've reached the 250th episode of the Bat Segundo Show, a broadcast long recognized as a civilized place for civilized conversations with today's leading artists. We're very proud of what we've accomplished in the past 4 years. We've had such leading heterosexual novelists as John Updike and Richard Ford, a number of Caucasians such as Mike Lee and Marilyn Robinson, and such male writers as Charlie Kaufman, Tobias Wolff, and Nicholson Baker. Thankfully, our very special guest for this program doesn't require us to single out her race, gender, or sexual orientation. Her name is Alison Bechtel, and she's simply a damn accomplished cartoonist. We'll let all the other media outlets apply these silly modifiers before cartoonist. As for us, well, we only apply such modifiers to the white male heterosexuals of our country, because frankly, these things are very important.
Okay, so it's my great pleasure to be here once again with Alison Bechtel, this time for the Essentials Dyke to watch out for. Alison, how are you doing?
I'm good, Edward. It's very lovely to see you.
Yeah, very lovely to see you again. I had a basic question concerning the looks of the characters. I think we should really clarify this for the record. I mean, the stripes on Moe's shirt have become more pronounced over the course of time. I mean, they increasingly grew thicker during the course of the early 90s, and then sometime around 1995, they solidified into that absolute thickness that we have enjoyed for the last decade or so. I know there have been many Harry Potter jokes that you've thrown around, but you were there, of course, before Harry Potter.
That's
but I
right.
have to ask you about the stripes. Had it occurred to you at any time to have Moe not wear a striped shirt, or did you feel that this was such an indelible part of her disposition?
I think there might be one scene where she's not wearing a striped article of clothing, mm-hmm. but I can't remember what it is or what its significance is. Huh. Indeed, the stripes did grow thicker.
Yeah.
Very good observation.
They did. It was really great to read this all in one burst because there are so many different character developments which I plan to ask you about. But maybe I could probably phrase this better by pointing out also Sparrow, for example, how the front curls that she had were chopped off to fit in with the adjusting times. And I'm wondering, when you decide to change the look of a character, what circumstances dictate that? And then some characters, of course, like Moe, stay the same over the course of time.
Wait, can I just make an observation? Thinking about those thickening black stripes, I think that's of a piece with the increasing darkness of the strip and indeed the era in which it was passing through.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe now,
true.
If I were continuing to write it, most stripes would get thinner and thinner.
Thinner.
No, I mean like literal, like figurative darkness.
Figurative darkness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there is some allegory here, I see. So
I'm totally bullshitting. This is good.
This is good.
But
we can give the listeners something to latch onto here. Great allegorical decisions upon your part. I mean, how much of this is intuitive and how much of this is really a conscious effort of like, okay, well, you know, most stripes, they look better. They just
no,
look
better.
It was
purely a visual decision. Yeah. I don't know. I used a different pen or something and it looked better, thicker.
Okay. What about Sparrow's hair?
Sparrow's hair. Well, what made me decide to do that? I don't know, but interestingly, it prefigured her and her like crossing over from being a lesbian to being a bisexual. I forget what she called herself, a bisexual lesbian?
I don't know.
She got involved with a man at any rate.
Yeah.
But she didn't want to completely let go of her lesbian title.
Yeah.
But she got this slightly more conventionally feminine-looking haircut.
Yeah, she did, she did.
Yeah.
I mean, did you plan her to essentially shack up with Sturt?
No, not
this,
at that point, no. Huh. I didn't.
How much does the visual decision like this predate the actual plotting or perhaps anticipated in some way? It's a very interesting observation here.
It is interesting. What's even more interesting is the way that these storylines and developments prefigure my own life or are a reaction to things going on in my own life, which I don't like to admit typically, but as I looked back over the book, I could see all these absurd parallels with my own life. It seemed almost indiscreet to have included them.
Huh. Like what, without giving too much away?
Oh, just like... It's hard not to give anything away. There was a period when a girlfriend of mine was having an affair, and I kind of very inappropriately played some of that out in the comic strip.
Oh, interesting. How much do you draw upon regular life? And I also want to ask you about the tip of the nibs. I mean, is this essentially a canvassing campaign on your part with readers? Do readers send in suggestions? Do you solicit ideas from readers to essentially get more authenticity?
I do both of those things. People always have besieged me with requests for specific types of characters, mostly ones exactly like them,
mm-hmm.
like a I've had requests for a Christian lesbian character, an Air Force lesbian character. People want to see their own self reflected in the strip, so that happens a lot. But also, I do actively consult with other people about things I don't know anything about, like children or real jobs. In some ways, I feel like if I had children or if I had a real job, I wouldn't have to do any of this research. I would just know what everyday life is like in these situations. But because I don't, I have to do all this work and research. Mm-hmm. And then I think, well, if I really had a job or if I had children, I wouldn't have time to write a comic strip about it.
Yeah.
So my trade-off is I have to research things that other people just know.
Yeah. Like, I mean, do you research largely just by asking people? I mean, how many people do you have to ask before you know that a particular detail is right or authentic enough to put in the strip?
I used to ask people a lot more because I didn't have the internet. Once I had the internet, I could minimize my human interactions somewhat, which is always a good thing. I know that's bad. I'm all about community. I really am, but I'm also sort of afraid of people.
Oh, you prefer to get emails as opposed to phone calls, essentially.
Oh my God, yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, this is a really interesting trend because I've noticed people are more increasingly, even people who are paid to use the phones are increasingly more terrified of them. It's really, and then we have automated scripts now. Yeah, exactly. God. Why is that? I mean, it's if you're doing a strip that is about detailing the behavioral patterns of people, it seems rather interesting to me that you're kind of terrified of them. Or is it really just kind of the sanctity of art here that permits you to exonerate yourself from this?
Well, in a way, I think maybe, I've never thought about this before, but I think that the comic strip world that I've created is sort of like someone who's a miniature train enthusiast and they spend all their time building their little train world.
Yeah.
And it's like a simulacrum of the real world because they can't handle the real world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wonder somehow if that's part of my what's going on for me. Like,
yeah.
Instead of, it's hard for me to go out and actually, I write about this community of friends because I wish I had it. But I'm not actually willing or able to go out and make it. I mean, I have a community, but it's not as tightly knit or as just all, 24 hours a day as theirs is.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, have you observed people in any capacity for this strip just to get details right? I mean, we talked about Fun Home. You had told me that you took photos of yourself to get gestures right, and I do have a question in relation to that, but I'm curious, does it start with the self, or does it involve this sense of observing other people and seeing how they act, or even for gestures, or even for particular dialogue and the like?
Yes. Yeah. I'm always looking at people. But I don't go out as much as I used to, and I live in the country. In the early days of writing Dykes to Watch Out For, I lived in Manhattan, and I was always feeling very overstimulated visually and really had this urge to just try and capture people and their gestures and what they're wearing. And that stimulation has decreased as I moved to the Twin Cities and then I moved to Vermont, and so there's less and less of a world impinging on me. But I can see stuff online.
That's an interesting observation because, I mean, as Dykes went on throughout the years, the details in the background started becoming more specific. There started to be a greater attention to little things in the kitchen. And in fact, actually, it's interesting when we're on the subject of talking about people, how much of this takes place actually in interiors as opposed to exteriors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They're easier, for one thing.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a domestic drama,
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But, I mean, I'm wondering if for some of the exterior tableaus that you had in this, whether moving to Vermont was a way of essentially taking all the visual influx that had stockpiled in your brain and then gradually kind of catching up so that there was some sense of equilibrium, I suppose.
I like that. Yeah, sort of titrating it out.
The silhouettes that you use in the strip early on, it seemed to me the first conscious effort on your part to really kind of shake up the art and to evolve the art. And I wanted to ask you about that and how the details announced themselves more and more over the course of specifically like the period in the early 90s where it really started to evolve, I think, the artistically.
It's funny to have the whole book in your hands and be able to see that development.
Yeah,
I feel like the art got better and better and then it started to degenerate over the last couple of years.
Why do you feel that?
Uh-huh. I can just see that it's kind of rushed and sloppy, yeah. And I haven't given everything the care that I had at the sort of peak, the sort of golden era, because I was much busier and under a lot more time pressure as time went on.
Was it Fun Home, essentially, that where you were diverting your attentions between the two, and you felt that you wanted to put all of your stock in the graphic novel so that you can get these specific details, and you can that did, I suppose, dwelling upon a community for so long force you to dwell more upon yourself, maybe? Or
I've always dwelled upon myself to a morbid degree.
How morbid, exactly?
I don't know. Well, as I turn more toward just doing memoir, that's kind of what I'm doing now. I guess I'm trying to figure it out and rationalize it. It seems incredibly solipsistic and selfish. So I'm trying to figure out my rationale. Like, really, I think it's, I'm trying to transcend myself.
Yeah.
But what does that have to do with the comic strip? I'm sorry, am I wandering?
No. This is good. I mean, do you have a... I mean, I'm sort of asking about how dwelling upon a community dwelt almost in reverse back to dwelling upon yourself, or perhaps in dwelling upon yourself and essentially spreading yourself out through numerous characters and aspects of yourself into numerous characters versus putting it all, I suppose, in one basket.
Yes. Well, in fact, all those characters in the comic strip are me.
Yeah.
Like, often people will say, are these based on your friends? Or some people, I think, have that soap opera syndrome where they actually think they're real people, and they say, you know, is Lois like really your friend? And no, they're all just aspects of my own personality. Maybe the comic strip represents a kind of multiple personality disorder, and now I'm actually getting myself together.
Huh.
To just focus on my one self.
Did you ever undergo therapy during the course of Dykes, or what?
Yeah, the whole time.
Yeah.
I've been in therapy for 20 years, Edward. Oh, okay. I remember seeing Annie Hall, and it was such a funny line where Woody Allen reveals that he's been in therapy for 15 years.
Yeah.
And I just realized I've way past that
landmark. Well, at the time, 15 years. I mean, he's been in therapy. Who
knows?
That's
true. God knows.
We don't know. I mean, he hasn't actually dispelled whether or not that's the case. Well, let's shift to the technology. I mean, I know that Dykes has pretty much been more or less ahead of the technological curve. You've had blogs, MySpace, podcasting.
Yes.
Vice City comes up at one point. And I have to say, I mean, you have a tendency to get there maybe a few months before the mainstream media picks up. And I wanted to ask you about this interest in technology and how this seems to constantly come up throughout the course of Dykes.
I just find that stuff exciting.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, too, how I guess the way that social change and technological change have together shaped the shifting course of events over the past 25 years. Like, when I think about gay and lesbian culture in particular, it's not just a social transformation. Everything has had an impact on it from, you know, the way the media landscape is changing, for example, and the internet and cell phones, and nothing is just one strand.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I'm not interested in technology in an abstract way, just I get seduced by gadgets and things, I just find them.
It's part of
compelling.
The social documenting experience, yes. Essentially.
Yes, like Proust, wasn't it Proust who had the first telephone call in a novel?
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
So I just try to keep abreast of those things.
Does being ahead of the game, both in terms of technology or even political issues, allow you to essentially remain current? I mean, I'm wondering if you fear, perhaps, that you may have managed to get to a particular topic, maybe after everybody else, that it's this notion of being first and dwelling upon a particular issue that gets you galvanized.
Oh, I guess it might be a little bit like that. But I know I've certainly been late on many things. I can't think of any examples right now, but I don't know. I mean, I also have had to, for the survival of the work, I've been forced to evolve my own technological knowledge constantly. You know, like when I started doing this, I was taking my artwork to the copy shop. It was before there was even a Kinko's. It was just like some random copy shop, and getting these terrible gray little photocopies made. You know, and over the years I went to photostats and higher quality Xeroxes, and I was mailing them. I was putting them in envelopes and with stamps on them and mailing them out to all these newspapers. It seems so primitive now.
Do you think the technology may have led you to become, from your own admission, lazier in your work later on towards the tail end of Dykes? Or?
Well, lazier in some ways. Like, I certainly, if you look at my original artwork, it's filled with mistakes because I stopped using whiteout the way I used to. I was forced to make my original art perfect. And now the original art can look like shit, but the digital version has to look perfect. So I would do the same amount of work on the computer. I don't know why, like, because I end up with no nice original art.
Yeah. Maybe it's not a matter of being lazy, it's a matter of using the tools that are at your disposal.
Well, it's a matter of being seduced by the technology. Yeah. I think I'm very easily led in that way. And even now, over the course of time, I've gone from writing the comic strip out in with pencil on a sketch pad to writing it in Adobe Illustrator on my computer.
You scanned your lettering then? Or?
I have a digital font of my own lettering. Like, a guy took my letters and made them into a font.
Yeah, I know a lot of cartoonists have had that happen. Yeah.
I feel a little conflicted about it. It's so much easier, but it feels also a little unethical. Like,
do you feel that technology is, in a certain sense, I suppose, phony? Or how do you keep things real, so to speak? Or does this even matter?
I think everyone draws their lines, so to speak, in different places. I'm sure Chris Ware does all his lettering by hand. You know, he wouldn't dream of using a digital font.
Not yet, anyway.
But other people do, and it's not a big deal. I just feel like I would like everything on the page to come out of my hand. And my rationalization with the digital lettering is it's still my hand. You know, it's from my own, you know, master my template lettering.
I wanted to ask you about just the sheer number of characters that you have had to manage with this strip. I note that pretty much from the beginning, in the first panel, or rather the first dramatic panel, you often have the characters refer to each other by their first name, so it's a very helpful guy. Like, oh, okay, that's Sparrow, that's...
I tried to always include everyone's name in each episode, you know, so people would know, but...
But I'm wondering if this might have been sort of a foreshadowing of things to come, that the, I suppose, base of 10 characters would expand into this happy family of like 80 or 90 or whatever it is, you know?
I wonder how many it is. I've never actually counted. Because they would come and go, you know, some of them would just go off the edges.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, have you done any kind of stock of your characters? Have you kept track of where your characters are at a particular point and where they plan to develop? Have you done any planning?
I keep a spreadsheet.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah. With the characters' names down the left-hand side and the episode numbers across the top.
Okay.
So I can chart what has happened to everyone and project what might happen to them. Uh-huh. I do more just keeping track of what I've done than projecting, even though that was the idea of the chart. But I never seemed to have time to look forward. I was always just rating each episode by the seat of my pants.
Yeah, yeah. Did the deadline essentially cause you to write something intuitive as opposed to go veer off onto the spreadsheet?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I would have arcs. I would have rough arcs planned out, but mostly it was all last minute. And I kind of like the effect of that as I look at the whole extended storyline over the years. It's kind of like real life. There isn't a lot of narrative finality or structure. Things just happen.
Did you ever get a sense that a particular character was flagging? I mean, we were talking about Sparrow and this transition by chopping off her front locks and then putting it with a man. Did you ever get any sense that, you know, oh, well, I have to sort of reinvent this character or galvanize this character in some way to make the character matter? And then you have to deal with the balance of how this character fits in with other characters. So you've got quite a chessboard here on your hands.
Yes, I did address that specifically with Mo, with sort of protagonist character. At some point, I've just felt like she was getting very tiresome and stagnant, and I needed to have some kind of character growth happen. But the challenge when you're working in a serial format is yes, you need to have growth and change, but everything has to remain familiar at the same time. So it has to happen in small, like, glacial increments. Mm-hmm. So I did have her kind of, I don't know, she had sort of a spiritual crisis. She stopped recycling.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But what happened to her? I can't remember how she came out of it.
Oh, she... Was it the it was the disposable diapers scenario? No, that was not Mo, but that was the difference between biodegradable diapers and disposable diapers. That was one thing.
I don't know.
Well, I wanted to ask you about media in this. You have newspapers and magazines and radio, but as a character sits down and reads the newspaper, we see a different headline for each particular panel. Likewise, with the radio messages or the message blurring from the television, you often have different things coming out of it. That, of course, is a little bit more natural, but at the same time, you point out to things that were actually transmitted through the radio that were actually true, that were remarkable pieces of propaganda. I'm wondering if this originated to, I suppose, keep the panels happening for you, because in some cases you're drawing characters or putting characters into situations where they're sitting on a couch and they have to sit on the couch in the next frame. And this is a way to kind of jazz it up for yourself? Or?
Yes, I think that was the original impetus. And the constantly changing phenomenon, I think, was something I got from Mad Magazine as a kid. I forget which... There was a particular artist who would do that in his backgrounds.
Mort Drucker?
Maybe Mort Drucker.
I think Mort Drucker had a tendency to do that with the movie satires that he did. Yeah.
So that's probably where I got that. But over time, I think my panels became almost like a, you know, like a CNN screen with crawls and market indicators and, you know, all kinds of like extra textual imagery going on. Just, I don't know, it's like this visual, what's that horror vacuee? Like, didn't we talk about this in my last episode? Or my last interview?
My last episode. This is the one in six. I like this idea, though. We should like have a series of conversations that goes like 10 or something over the course of 2 years. But I think we did, as a matter of fact. I did listen to it, but I don't recall specifically what we identified it as.
I have a fear of empty space. Yeah. So it was just a way of like cramming more information into these panels. And also, I think it reflects my desire for a soundtrack. I would love to have, you know, to be able to use the element of sound in the strip, to have television and radio noise going on.
Text and images are not enough. You need to have some additional punchy element to ensure that this is a great piece of art with heft of some sort.
Well, I'm fascinated with what the strip came to be for me was a weaving together of, yes, these characters' stories, their soap opera, their domestic dramas, but with things that were happening in the broader world, with current events. And sometimes those things would just kind of bounce off one another, like they just were happening at the same time, and sometimes they would actually be more thematically integrated. Like, I would illustrate I did a cartoon about, it was called Foreign Policy.
Yeah.
And it was drawing parallels between parenting techniques and Bush's foreign policy.
And you did this a couple of times, too,
this
theme of like parables. A symbolic, almost a semiotics of how regular domestic behavior can be easily translatable into some sort of foreign or news from the headlines.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that. So that's why I like bringing in the outside event.
I also wanted to ask you about some of the strips that are in this that have little to no dialogue. For example, Real World, which was done shortly after 9/11, as well as Sleep Sister, where the cat dies. And it's done largely with the illustrations. There's very little that is spoken in that particular strip. And I wanted to ask you about, were these efforts to work on your art, or was it just simply the mood felt that it didn't need to be cluttered with text, that it didn't need the CNN scenario that we were describing earlier?
I think, definitely. In the 9/11 strip, I was working very hard with all my usual elements, with my TV and my dialogue and everything. And it just was, it was so difficult to, you know, not trivialize what had happened. And finally my girlfriend at the time said, "What are you doing? Just like get rid of all the words."
Huh.
So that was really not my idea. I wish it had been, but it worked. You know, gave it up just more proper solemnity. And I guess I was thinking of that too when I was dealing with that the dead cat episode. I would love to use more silent panels in general. It's a powerful and visually restful thing to do. But I was always so constrained. You know, I had 10 or 12 panels to tell a whole story with the beginning and a middle and an end, and to shoehorn in these current events. So it was very hard to ever have a lot of visual leisure to have silence like that. Yes. Or even to have more than the characters' heads ever showing. It was rare that I got to draw people's whole bodies just because of the format. Yeah. Couldn't ever really stretch out.
Going back to the tableaus I was referring to earlier, where you have three or four people generally crammed into the frame, there were more of those going on as the strip progresses. It almost becomes cinematic. I mean, this makes me wonder about where the origins of these panel ideas come from, whether they are... I wanted to think that they were actually more taken from real life and observation, but you have essentially killed off that theory. But I'm wondering, I mean, were these taken from, you know, films or other comic books?
I think a lot of other comic books and strips were probably the strongest influence. Hergé taught me a lot about just how to fit a lot of people into a scene. A lot of underground stuff I was reading in my early 20s, like R. Crumb, R. and Aileen Crumb's work, Harvey Pekar, and the strips, like For Better or For Worse, just seeing how people handled that kind of serial storytelling.
There was one thing, and this is perhaps a strange question, but I have noticed over the tendency of the entire run of Dykes that often people are bent over. And initially, you have no problem showing the butt. And then later on, I notice that you start cutting the butt at a certain point, so, but they're still bending over. Or you show them from the front. And I have noticed this, and I have to ask the question.
I haven't noticed the butt phenomenon. I know that I got more like censorious over the years. I was a little more careful about what kind of body parts I was exposing.
Yeah, and language too as well.
Yes, yes, I did. I started using all the ampersands and things instead of cuss words.
Was this something that came with having the strip distributed in more newspapers?
Yeah,
that,
it was.
Did you piss off clients or?
I started getting requests from some papers occasionally. Can you take the nipples out of this, or can you take the fuck out of this? And I didn't like doing it, but I would always do it.
Huh. I'm wondering if this might have led you more towards the memoir, that this censorious nature as opposed to this liberated nature or unfettered nature that was in the...
I'm all about the liberation. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No more getting censored and getting physically liberated out of those small spaces.
Yeah,
you know?
And the four rows as well.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, I never saw a single Dykes strip that wasn't in that four-row setup. I mean, I was wondering if you had ever considered, like, because it's printed in a certain way in a newspaper where you only, it's going to be smaller than it is in the book here.
Right.
Did you consider perhaps chopping that up into, like, two big mammoth rows of something?
Well, I could never do that. I never had that freedom because this is sort of complicated and geeky, but those four tiers get laid out in different ways. Like, strip was designed to be horizontal, to run across the bottom of a tabloid page.
Uh-huh.
So they have to go 1, 2, 3, 4. You can put them vertically, 1, 2, 3, 4, but you can't cut them in half and move those two over here, because then it would go 1, 3,
yeah,
2, 4.
I see what you're saying.
So I could never... I always had to use the four tiers. I could never do two big boxes.
Wow. So how many clients actually ran the strip across that?
Most places did.
Really?
But
okay.
Then I guess what I'm trying to say is when the strip came out in book format, the layout would revert to 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is interesting because I read you initially from the web, and so it was always laid out in the four tiers. And so in my mind, I'm like, it'd be interesting to actually. I mean, I guess you could buy a copy of the book, cut it up, and sort of see how it looks. It's interesting.
Well, it just was that I always was working with two, like, forums in mind.
Yeah.
And it was worth the effort. I think the strip was different. If you picked it up in the newspaper every 2 weeks, it had a much more like everyday quotidian feel to it. It's part of your breakfast routine or and the current events that it cites are more vivid. They're like actually happening while you're reading it, hopefully. And in the book, when you can read them all together and you're out of that specific moment in time, it's more, I think, of a story, and you can focus more on the stuff happening with the characters.
I have to also ask you, I mean, this is a general question, but nevertheless one that I don't really have an answer for as to the concern of Mad Woman books versus the brand names that sound suspiciously similar to certain big box stores.
I'll be reading tonight.
Yeah, did you? Exactly. The great irony here.
Would
you say that you've sold out? I don't know. But, I mean, why this concern? Did you work in a bookstore at any point? I know you worked office jobs, but...
No, I never did work in a bookstore. Huh. But bookstores did have a really particular meaning and value in the lesbian and gay community.
Sure.
Just that's where people got all their information. And their roommates and their girlfriends and boyfriends. Like, they were really community centers, these places.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way that some independent bookstores are, but it was even more intensified, I think, for women's and gay bookstores. So it just seemed like a natural nexus for my comic strip. Like, this is where the characters would meet and have their social lives. And it was such a cultural forum, too, so I could get a lot of stuff happening there.
As opposed to a cafe or a bar?
Yes. I mean, because, in a bookstore, you have books and ideas, and you have newspapers and everything that's going on in the world. So I didn't really give it a lot of thought. It was just instinctive, because that's what bookstores were to me. They were these... I keep wanting to say the word nexuses, but is that right? Nexi?
I think it's nexuses, but we will accept nexi in this broadcast. I have to ask you about the introduction of Sturt. Going back to the censorious aspect that we were talking about earlier, I do know that when you introduced Sturt, there was some upcry from the dyke community.
Yes.
And did you anticipate any of this, or did you do this to shake things up? Did you essentially want to keep things, I suppose, as multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multi-gender as you can?
I felt like Sturt's appearance was really quite organic. That I wasn't trying to push people's buttons. I wasn't doing it because I felt a need to be more inclusive. I really just felt like this is what the people around me were doing. You know, in my early days, I lived in a sort of de facto lesbian separatist setup. I didn't call myself a separatist, but I didn't really have many men in my life at all. And it was very important to me in the comic strip to create women who were real subjects. And to me, that part of the way of doing that was to not show them in relation to men.
Yeah.
So they could just be their own selves. And I always hoped that men would be able to read it and identify with these female subjects, like the way I would identify with Garfield.
Exactly.
Good, there you go.
Yeah.
So I think I just lightened up after a while. I felt like, okay, enough, I've achieved this. I don't have to, like, keep men out of the strip. I can let men in the strip because we can handle it.
Yeah.
And so that was the point that Sturt appeared.
But this outcry, so to speak, I mean, is that why he adjusted and became this freakish public transportation? He became almost this kind of... almost this archetype of the world's worst liberal environmentalist.
In some ways, he kind of usurped that role from Mo, and I realized Mo had kind of gone into the background while he became the big fetchy.
Yeah.
You know.
That's very interesting, too. Yeah. Mo almost became a little bit more multidimensional as Sturt became more one-dimensional, I suppose, as it went on.
I do feel bad that I used Sturt for a lot of cheap jokes.
Yeah.
And not necessarily even at his expense, but that somehow... bringing a man in, I was able to make these kind of jokes that I don't really approve of, you know. Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example, like...
Like the him bicycling the babies in traffic, that kind of thing, or what?
Oh, like one time when he couldn't find the conditioner in the bathroom because he needed it to keep his beard silky.
Yeah.
Like,
and then Lois had done it for her trans...
Like, right. I don't know. That just felt like sort of a cheap shot.
Huh.
Not in a way exactly, just... Just using gender as a joke, I don't think I really approve of that.
Huh. Were there any other cheap shots that you feel you made during the run?
Or? Yeah, there are. I can't think of them now. I should make a whole presentation of my cheap shots.
Yeah. Why'd you make them if you...
Well, because it was easy, because I'm under a lot of pressure. I got a deadline. I want something... I need a way to tie the strip up, so I just do some dumb little... They're not that dumb. I shouldn't... I'm making it sound more egregious than perhaps it actually is. But I feel like I could have worked a little harder and made things more nuanced and complex sometimes. But it was often easy with Stuart to get a cheap laugh.
Huh. I'm wondering if it was a pressure to make the strip funny as opposed to being a story. Because that's what it really is, I think.
Yeah, it has some funny moments, but really it's not comic in that sense. I tried not to really think about being humorous because I found that was very counterproductive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can't be an automatic gag machine. Well, you're trying to portray these particular characters.
In my early days, I did do a gag format strip. When the strip began, it was a New Yorker cartoon, like a single image with a one panel gag, and that really wore out quickly. That was very hard to keep that up. That's why I went to storytelling, because I didn't have that same pressure to be funny or clever.
Did you have pressure from clients to be more funny? Or?
Yeah. For a while, I was doing another comic strip, sort of a parallel comic strip about a gay and lesbian newspaper for The Advocate, that magazine. And the editor there worked with me a lot to make me have a punchier kind of humor.
And this was completely anathema to your voice, I suspect.
Well, I understood the need for it, and in some ways, it's just good writing. Like, I appreciated that input, but yeah, it was. I did resent it a little bit. It felt like punchlines were kind of phallic.
Yeah. I have to also ask you about the role of politics in this strip. We've alluded to it a couple of times, but for example, you know, Clarice's Catatonia. And the strip that you did, in which you depict yourself as the cartoonist, unable to come up with an idea because you're bombarded with all this influx of information.
Oh, during the impeachment.
During the impeachment hearings, and so this is very intriguing that it comes up with Clarice's Catatonia right after Bush gets elected, and I'm wondering, are political events a kind of pressure upon you to deliver? In what sense are they helpful? In what sense are they harmful? In what sense do they get in the way of depicting normal people?
I'm not a natural news junkie. I don't. If I were left to my own devices, I would go without reading a newspaper for long periods of time. I do feel a certain civic responsibility to know what's going on in the world, and I think I enacted that somewhat in the comic strip, or used the comic strip to make following the news more palatable and comprehensible to myself. That's why I would take these political issues and try and domesticate them, like try and put them on a level that made more sense to me, like the foreign policy thing. Like, what if we did treat other countries like toddlers? Mm-hmm. You know, that would just somehow help me to make sense of the world. That was my main motivation in doing it. That and I felt kind of I have a didactic streak. I want to make sure I like conveying information, and I felt like this was a way to not just explain the world to myself, but to the people reading the strip, so mm-hmm. I couldn't help that sometimes.
So it was a way for you to understand the world, the strip.
Yes.
Well, I have to ask, because of current events, I mean, this strip is now on hiatus.
Yeah, man, I'm glad, too.
Well, but are you glad? Because, I mean, we're now in a scenario after Prop 8, in which we have seen a mobilization that is, I think, almost unprecedented. All of a sudden, activism is militant again. People, I suppose, are recovering from the fear of Bush, are now out in the streets. They were out in the streets here, protesting all the Mormons and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if this is something of a responsibility that you... You mentioned civic responsibility before. Do you have a civic responsibility to continue the strip in any form?
Interestingly... A lot of people are referring to the Prop 8 reaction as Stonewall 2.0. I feel like maybe a younger cartoonist wants to do that. You know, I'm kind of tired. I know, and although I recognize the injustice of Prop 8, I can't get extremely fired up about it. We're gonna have to stop.
Okay.
That's gonna be the
no worries. You have to go, but Allison, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you,
taking
Ed.
The time out.
This is really great.
Great, thanks.
Get money.